chapter 3, picking up there in verse 9. You recall, of course, verses 1 through 8, a very poetic section, maybe one of the best known, if not the best known, sections in the book, where there's a time and a season for every purpose under heaven. And he goes through several of those that we'll remind ourselves of in just a moment. But verse 9, then, he's going to continue on and talk about an established order of God's working in this world and various things, of course, related to that as he's talking about all those things under the sun. So let's read Ecclesiastes 3, verses 9. Let's go through 11, 9 through 11. Who will grab that for us?
What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts. Expect that no one can find out the work that God has from beginning to end.
Okay. So, what profit has a worker from that in which he labors? If you take a quick peek back to chapter 1, verse 3, he had mentioned that before, kind of as an introductory. But this is following 1 through 8. And 1 through 8 just remind us sort of in a summary way of what he's mentioning there. We know time and seeds for every purpose, but so time to be born, time to die. Opposites, right? A time to plant, time to pluck. So he gives these extremes and is pointing out there are changes in life. There are times for those, time for different things to happen, to unfold, to be executed, to be done. So there's all of that. And so if you plant and then you pluck what is planted, or there's a time to kill and a time to heal, what's really the point or the good of any of it? What profit is there in being engaged in these things if it goes from one to the other and back and forth and up and down and, if you will, like that? Plus, there are things that we cannot control. We live in a real world. We have to learn to deal with what unfolds and what happens. Sometimes what we work to accomplish can be wiped out overnight. I know there have been times where people have been, let's say, invested in the stock market or a particular stock, and all of a sudden it crashes, and what they had is cut in half or almost totally obliterated. Other things could be shown like that. Maybe somebody gets involved in a lawsuit and they lose their business, or other types of things happen. So there are those times when circumstances go against us. There are times when circumstances are favorable to us. And so we get out there, we work, we labor, we're pushing toward a goal, and you know, all of a sudden things change on us. So what profit is there for this? In verse 10, what's he telling us there? I have seen the God-given task which sons of men are occupied. You mentioned this before, sort of similar here, but in the context of verses 1 through 8 so far in this chapter, what would a God-given task be?
Eternal rest.
Well, We're looking forward to that. He talks about eternity being put in their hearts here in just a minute. But in verse 10 there, God given, when you think of task, what do you think of? Go ahead, Zach, and then John.
Yeah, just, I think we touch on this later in this chapter, the next mm-hmm. lesson as well, but the idea of our work, our labor, God's given us that as a task / gift. He's given that to us. We have a related thought in the New Testament, in Ephesians chapter 2, about creating four good works. So I know that's different than this idea, but God's given us work to do. There's our worldly labor, and then there's stuff that he asks us to do for the kingdom.
Yes. John.
Well, basically to say what Zach said, that we have tasks, obviously, that we're given to. The previous chapter says that, you know, God has given us things to do on this earth and that we enjoy the fruits of those labors. But I think he's trying to get us, I think Solomon himself is seeing this, but trying to get us to see the difference between gifts and tasks on this earth and their value versus the gifts of eternal life. So he's describing the difference between those and trying to develop us to see these things that, yes, we have tasks to do on this earth or gifts from God. Sometimes they're arduous, but there's something better out there, which we need to keep in mind while we're performing those. And if we keep the eternal things in mind, then we're going to live in accordance with God's word as God's servants should.
Mike, you have something to add?
No, I was just going to say, you know, there are very specific responsibilities we have, whether it be to provide for our families, you know, whatever it is. Those are the tasks that
Yeah. Looking again at Ecclesiastes 3, where we've picked up tonight, verses 9 through 11, after that section where he talks about, you know, the season, there's a purpose for everything under heaven. And there in verse 10, you know, there's a God-given task. Why doesn't God just give us everything? You know, why doesn't he just... Hey, here's your crop. You don't have to plant. You don't have to pluck. Here's the food on your table. Part of what he's working through here is this is the way God has set up the world. In his providence, he's working in this world, but understand that we have labor. And there are things that are difficult. There are things that are uncertain. But that's good for us. That's a blessing to us. Why would those kinds of things be a blessing to us? I didn't know. Linda, did you have something?
Well, I was just thinking that, I mean, in the garden, he had Adam take care of everything. And then when they sinned, he said, now by the sweat of your brow, you're going to get what you need. So... part of the reason we have to work is because Adam and Eve sinned. But also, it's good for us to be doing something. If we're idle, we start getting into trouble.
Okay, and we're going to circle back around that to that in just a minute with the exact thing that you just mentioned there. And we have these challenges that will help us to grow. They strengthen us as we go through them. Anytime, you know, you take, it, for instance, a world-class athlete, one of the things they do is they challenge themselves and they want to shift it and change it up. They don't want to do the same thing all the time. So they don't fall into, I guess, a rut, but they need to exercise. They need to strengthen themselves in various ways. I mean, you know, there are golfers and tennis players that lift weights, or they might do yoga, or, you know, they might be big runners or something like that. But they go outside that area, but they stretch themselves to strengthen themselves, to help them overall. And then, you know, people who work with weights, they want to stress their muscles in different ways. Otherwise, they're not going to get the growth that they're seeking, the enhancement that they're going for. So if you think of life as a series of exercises or challenges that they'll make us stronger as we go through. We face things that are uncertain and we have to figure out how to get through them or how to deal with adversity and setbacks and things like that. In God's providence, he's working that out in our lives and in this world for good so that we can grow. Rick, did you have something?
I was just going to say basically what Linda had said about the garden, that God had given us a task from the beginning. Adam had the tasked to care for the garden. And then once it went into, after they sinned, they had more tasks, more grievous tasks.
Yes.
But anyway, that was the main thing I was thinking. And another thing to think about is God has given us tasks and he has made, I'm going to go to the next verse. But anyhow, he's made everything beautiful in its time.
Okay.
Even their tasks are, you know, there's a reason, and it's beautiful in its time.
You're taking us right where I want to go.
Okay.
Very good. Even those tasks, you know, everything, he's made everything beautiful in its time. Even the hardships are beautiful in their time. To think about, okay. I was thinking about this today in preparing for this. I've known a couple of families who have special needs children, Down syndrome or other things. And my observation is, I'm not sure I could ever do that. That is a huge challenge in their life. They deal with things that I cannot even imagine dealing with. But they've made comments like, they wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. There's a blessing in the midst of that challenge that they have a child who is always going to be very childlike and they will be responsible for until they leave this earth. And then they're concerned about who's going to help take care of them when I'm gone if the child lives that long. But they learn things like, what it is to just have pure innocence, pure sweetness, pure love. Different things they see in that child's personality, behavior. You know, so there's a beauty even in the midst of a challenge like that. And there's beauty in the world around us. You know, there's beauty in war and there's beauty in peace. It's beautiful in its time. There's a purpose. There's a reason. There is a season for those things to bring about good and right in this world. As we talked about before, you know, sometimes we look at some of those things that he's listed out before and we think, well, that's inherently bad. Well, no, it's not inherently bad. In its time, in its season, it's good and it's right. Any other thoughts, Mike? Do you have some? All right, very good. So, question number 5 I had asked out of verse 11, what does it mean he has put eternity in their hearts? What is it that he's put eternity in the hearts of men?
Well, to me, there's kind of a twofold thing going on here. One is literally the soul is eternal. That's the obvious of the eternity. But the other thing is that man inherently desires for there to be something bigger and more powerful than himself. And virtually every society that has been discovered or studied has some form of worship for something greater and stronger than themselves. And those are derivations of what came out of the garden eventually. Evolved into other things as wickedness grew, but still it's the same concept, worshiping something greater than ourselves.
John.
I think, you know, Romans 1 and 2 kind of takes us down this road where each individual has observations that they can make in the world to see the grand eternal design of things. Man has within them this knowledge of right and wrong, but we also have within us, because of these trials and tribulations that we go through, this dissatisfaction of what we're going through in this life, we yearn for something better, eternal, as a result of those things. So if we can see it, it's innate in us and we know it, and we have a dissatisfaction with the sin in our lives, and we yearn for something better, and that's heaven. We may not know those things perfectly without the Word of God, but we have that within us to reach out and learn those things.
Okay, so both these concepts, first one that Nancy mentioned about we have this eternal soul within us, And it's because we have that eternal soul that is distinct from animal life that we long for that which is eternal. We long for God. We long for truth. We long for heaven. And yes, men have tried to figure out how to satisfy that longing in many different ways. Satan will come along and give us an alternative. But the entire book of Ecclesiastes is about how do you satisfy that longing? Where do you find that contentment, that peace within yourself, that grasping on to that eternity? So he's put eternity in our hearts, and we're looking for that greatness of God, of his truth, and having fellowship with him. But even though we're made in the image of God and we have that within us, he says, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. What about that? Who knows the working of God? What does Isaiah say about it? Or Isaiah records it, Isaiah 55. Yeah, we, as intelligent, and even though we are made in the image of God, we cannot figure out his ways. We're not going to do it. He has wisdom that is far beyond ours. He sees the whole picture. We can't see the whole picture. We would like to, wouldn't we? Okay, some people don't want to see the whole picture, and I do agree with that. There's so much, the older I get, I don't want to know. I just leave me out of that. But there are things in our own personal lives that we would like to know. Right? How many of us have wanted to know, okay, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I want to know this, or maybe next week. Maybe we're going to look for a job, or our spouse is going to look for a job, or a child's going to look for a job, and we want to know the answer. We want to know right now. Right? Or in a relationship, is this relationship going to work out? We want to know these things, but it's not good for us to know them. Otherwise, God would give us that ability to see into the future. We can't see that. We don't know how it's going to unfold or play out. And that's for our benefit. And part of that learning patience and trusting in God and all those types of things. But we can't find out his working, you know, from beginning to end. We won't be able to do that. We can look back and see things perhaps in our lives, but we can't figure it all out. So let's jump to verses. Go ahead, Ron.
Steve, is it accurate to say that the things that we know of God are only the things that he has revealed to us?
Yes. He's revealed them either through revelation or in creation. We can know that God exists from creation. We can look back in our lives and see where God has blessed us in different ways, where at the time we may not even have seen it or recognized it, but now we can look back and say, that was a blessing. Or God opened a door for me there, and I was blessed in that. But yeah, he has to somehow reveal that to us. We can't, you know, the secret things belong to God. We can't know the mind of God separate from what he has revealed in his word. And all right, so verses 12 to 15, let's read those. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 12 through 15. Who will grab that for us? Chris.
I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing can be taken from it. And God does it that men should fear before him. That which has already been, and what is already, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past.
All right. So back in verse 12, nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives, that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. And he's touched on this before. He's going to touch on it again later in his letter. And it just reminds us again, Solomon is not a fatalist. He's not saying life is just horrible and awful because there's things we don't understand or things we can't control. He's giving us a realistic assessment of life, and as John said a while ago, helping us to understand the relative value of things, and the value of the things of this world are really not that much, but enjoy what you have. You go through the ups and downs of life, enjoy the times that it's good, and doing things are going well. So question number one on this lesson I ask, what is the gift of God and what should men do with it? So we kind of answered part of that, but what is the gift of God here?
I think there's a system in place that if you do the right thing, you do the good thing, you're going to be able to enjoy the fruit of your labors.
Okay. In the New Testament, if it says if you don't work, you shouldn't what?
Eat.
So what does that imply on the reverse side?
If you're eating, you're working.
Well, if you work, you should be able to eat, right? There should be a reward, and it's the way the world is set up, the way that it's built. And even people in the world recognize this. People respect other people who work and labor, and they will reward them for that work and that labor. Whether that's as an employee or as somebody performing a service for them, they will reward us for that, generally speaking. So, yeah, this is the way things are set up. I thought I saw a hand over. Maybe not. All right. So labor in and of itself, let's understand, is to be enjoyed. So getting back to what Linda brought up, Adam and Eve in the garden, what were they told to do? Okay, not what they were not told not to do. What were they told to do?
Everything. Brain dead. Okay, yeah.
To tend and keep it.
There you go.
What is that? Tending and keeping.
Labor.
Maintenance, work, labor. Okay, they're... People who have seen when Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, they said, well, work is a curse. Work is not a curse. The curse was that it was going to be harder. Instead of being in the garden, tending and keeping it, you got to go out, you got to plow that ground, you got to deal with thorns and thistles and by the sweat of your brow. The work became more difficult, but the work is good for us. As Linda said a while ago, we get our minds idle. We're not tending to something. We'll go places, do things we shouldn't be doing. Wasting time for one of them beyond anything else. Zach?
And that sets up this idea of the eternal rest, the Sabbath rest. If there's no work, there's no rest. If rest is a promise, is something we look forward to, we wouldn't look forward to it if we rested all year all the time. They have to go hand in hand.
Okay, yeah, in the law of Moses, it specifically said, 6 days man shall do his work and rest on the Sabbath, on the seventh day. So work six, rest one. Work six, rest one. Pointing to, like you say, that future Sabbath rest in eternity that we'll have when we're working and laboring in this world in the kingdom, looking forward to that Sabbath rest. But yeah, work is a good thing for us. Mike? Paul, do you have something?
Yeah. You said it, but actually, if there's no work, you can't enjoy the rest.
If you're not working?
Yeah, the rest is really enjoyed. ever you've been working.
Right. Because if you're resting all the time, you become restless. Okay. Right? Okay. Okay. So, and we think about this, you know, some people are unable to work because of physical handicaps or whatnot. Some people are unable to, and we take pity on them. And they long, they just wish they had the ability to get out and work. Where some of us, we get out and work, and then we complain about the work. So, you know, the fruit of our labor is to be enjoyed and appreciated and to be thankful to God that we're able to do that and that He set the world up, that we can work and labor and provide for our needs and the needs of our family. So question number two I ask, what is described in verses 14 and 15 and how should man react and why? So I know whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him, and so on. So, what's He talking about here? Whatever God does, it shall be forever.
Well, to me, I feel like He's saying God created everything, put everything in motion. He established a pattern, and that's not going to change. You have to accept that and understand His power. Recognize that He is the one that, you know, keeps everything going, that He is in charge of everything. So, you know, we should respect that.
Chris?
I kind of see it as there's nothing you want to sum. What He has created, He has created. It was created then, and it exists today as it has been created. The earth was made whole.
That which is, has already been. That which is to be, has already been.
I guess I see it more in the immediate context of what He's talking about, of this labor and fruit of that. You know, that's always been, it always will be. As long as man's on the earth, it's the way it's going to be. I guess it's just one example of what we're talking about on the bigger picture.
Yes, yes, there is the grand, huge picture. For instance, like it says all the way back in Genesis, there's going to be, as long as the earth remains, there's going to be winter and summer. There's going to be heat and cold. It's going to be. And there's nothing that man's going to do about that. We could not purposely set about to destroy the environment and accomplish it. We could not do that. Now, could we go out and pollute a field or a river or something? Sure, we can do that. But you let a little time pass, and the way God's created nature, it's going to clean it up. It's just going to happen. We're not going to change that. Coming down to like Mike is talking about, the way God has set up the world, the rules that govern the world, they're not going to be changed. And if we try to act outside of those, we're going to run into problems. We're going to be frustrated. And in our society right now, just maybe a modern application, we've got this whole idea that there's all these multiple types of genders. Man, people are, we haven't even begun to see the negative ramifications of that's going to mess so many people up. And they're going to constantly run into this frustration. You can't go against what God has established in order of the way He has made things. You can't improve on it. We can't alter it. We can't make it better. We can try to fight against it, but it's really a futile fight. Nancy?
Well, none of us are creationists. I mean, we can't create from nothing. So in that sense, nothing's going to change. Nothing that we can't.
We can rearrange.
To add or take away.
Right.
But when I look at this, it struck me that God has established righteousness. And we can't add to or take away from that. And His righteousness is going to be forever. And we're going to be the ones who have to give an account for our behavior in this world. because he has established what righteousness is.
Okay, in this next section, and this so kind of flow over from 14, 15 to 16, 17, you may or may not have a break there in your text and the way they've put it. But one of the things he's getting into is these inequities in life. Mike.
I just want to finish up the thought that I have was that it doesn't matter if you're an atheist or you know you're a member of the church, anything in between, it doesn't matter. A lot of people go to work and they can't quite explain why. But this verse tells us why. Because God has put something in order so that man just kind of does it.
People generally want to work. Generally. Now, I know in our society we have a real problem with labor shortage and this, that, and the other, and that's not the overall discussion. Overall, people want to work. People want to be occupied. They want to be doing something that's productive, creative, that, you know, contributes in some way to the world, to their family, or to whatever. They want to do that. That's right. And that's ingrained in humanity.
See, in addition to the things that we're talking about, we also know boundaries and habitations, that it, essentially people are living where they always lived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the areas that are settled are occupied. Nations are nations, and they've continued to be that way. So there, yes, there's been some movements of boundaries and things, but in a typical way, the things that God established in those nations even exist to this day in a very general way.
Well, and the languages, you know, from Genesis 11 forward, you know, all those different types of things. Yeah, exactly right. Men have generally formed governments. They don't remain in a chaotic anarchy of just, you know, self-rule every little family. They join together. They build coalitions, all kinds of things like that. Exactly right. And the world is the way that it is, and we would drive ourselves crazy if we try to alter that. But then also we can drive ourselves crazy by looking out and seeing an injustice in this world or a tragedy in this world and not coming to terms with it. You know, some people do that. They see or they experience a tragedy, they don't come to terms with it, and their life is shot. They can't move forward, can't get beyond it. And I have to say this, there in our nation, there have been occasions, maybe I'm the only one who's witnessed this, but some people can't get over an election. They absolutely cannot get over the way that a particular election turned out, whether that's local, state, or national. They just can't get over it. And they just obsess and obsess and obsess over it. And that's true on both sides of our political divide that we have in this nation. It's true on both sides. They just obsess over it. And it drives them crazy. And they get filled with bitterness and anger and hatred and envy and jealousy and all those kinds of things. And that's no good. That is just no good. One of the things we have to learn from the Word of God is that God raises men up and He takes men down. And if we back up, I don't understand all that from beginning to end. I know this. I remember back in, what was it, 1992? How in the world did this guy from Arkansas get elected? How did that? Why? Why? And then there's been some more since then, like, why? I don't understand it, but it's God's working. And so we need to learn to come to terms with these things. Not that we say necessarily that they're good, a tragedy, an injustice in life, but just learning, look, that's a part of the way the world is. And we need to trust in God as we go through these things. God is going to judge men. Let's read now verses 16 and 17. Just 16, 17. Who will grab that for us? Philip.
Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there,
and the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time, there is for every purpose and for every work.
Okay, so question three I asked, what did Solomon see under the sun that disturbed him?
Injustice, corruption, and universality of sin.
I just said that life is not fair.
I want to come back to that, Nancy.
Well, yeah, and then what I had was that he saw corruption, and it can exist on any level. So it could be spread throughout society. It could be to people an injustice. It can be at the highest court in the land an injustice.
Okay. Life is not fair, okay? People who want to establish fairness in a society are those people who are going to be frustrated again and again and again. There is not fairness. Why is there not fairness in this world?
Sin.
Sin, right? Sin, the corruption. Satan gets to people. Because God gives us free will, because God allows us to make the choice of whether to serve Him or to turn our back on Him, there's going to be this injustice in the world, and it has to be this way. Why is it that we have to have a choice? So that then it opens this possibility of injustice, unrighteousness taking place. Why do we have a choice?
God has set about to prove us. He wants us to show Him what He means of us.
Okay. Anything to add to that?
Well, because God wants willing service, and therefore we have to choose. We have to choose Him.
Yeah, to me, it's what is the point of having something like with our children? What would we rather have? Our child do what we ask because they trust us and know that we love them and are looking out for their well-being? Or because we said, if you don't do it, you won't be able to do this, or you'll have to sit in your room, or you have to punish them in order to get them to do what's right. Well, it's the same way with God. He wants us to love Him of our free will because we see what He's done for us, because we trust Him, because we know He wants what's best for us.
Okay, the key word, love. Love cannot exist without choice. God wants us to love Him and everything that we've been talking about, to willingly serve Him, to show Him that love. But if we don't have a choice, there's no love involved. It's just submission or robotic performance, right? And because we have a choice, then it opens up the door for the devil to do his work, which brings the injustice, the wickedness, the iniquity, the corruption, as Nancy was saying, at all levels, whether it's a throne or a court or wherever it might be. In the Bible, there are several examples. Think about Naboth. You know, what justice did Naboth get? Other than the fact that God took care of Jezebel later and dogs ate her up, right? And then she became dog excrement. That's what he specifically said. That's what's going to happen to you. You know, Naboth and his family, they were not treated justly in this world. And there are other examples. The ultimate, of course, is Jesus Christ. It was a miscarriage of justice. Isaiah 53 talks about that idea. There's a miscarriage of justice here with the Son of God. And so, again and again, we see that. And it's disturbing to those of us who love righteousness to see injustice in this world. It can eat away at us, but we can't let that happen. We need to trust in Him. And what is it that He says, verse 17? He comes back and He tells us, hey, there's injustice, there's wickedness, but what's going to happen?
Basically tells us that He has a peace of mind, that He has peace within Himself, because he has the knowledge that God is in control and he's going to judge these folks for what they've done, just like he's going to judge us, hopefully, for doing righteousness. That makes it all okay.
Right. God's going to settle all accounts in the end.
Well, and justice is something that God is very important to God. When we read in Micah where he said, he has shown you, O man, what is right and what you should do. And basically he just says to do justly and to walk humbly with your God.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, justice is pivotal in our individual actions. We should love justice and walk humbly.
Yes. Yes. We want to make sure we're doing right, just like he had said before, you know, to rejoice and to do good in your life in verse 12. We need to be doing that good and doing just by others and even going beyond that and bending over backwards. There are times where, you know, especially in the New Testament, it tells us we need to take the wrong. You know, we need to accept that sacrifice, that injustice for the greater good, and trusting in God as we go through those difficult times. And in a sense, that's kind of what he's saying here, but ultimately God's going to bring all men to account. You know, whatever we see going on in our nation, whatever injustice we are grieved over even today, you know what? Those who are in power, they very well may get away with it, because we know them, they've gotten away with it before. But they're going to have to give an account to God. And so we can rest assured in that. They'll be called to account. All right, let's read verses 18 to 22, please, as we wrap up chapter 3. 18 to 22, who'll grab that? Mike?
I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place, all came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of beast descends downward to the earth? I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him?
Okay, question four I ask, how does God test men and what does this cause them to realize? Did I say question three? Question four. How does God test men? Verse 18.
He tests us through difficulties and through blessings.
Okay. Test us through the way the world works, right? He's been talking really about this from verse 1. Hey, you got time to be born, time to die, time to plant, time to pluck, time to kill, time to heal, time of war, time of peace. All these things. He puts us to the test, and we're shown to be without real power, if you will, in this world. And it ought to humble us and see our need for God and his guiding wisdom and care in this life. And he tells us, you know, we look now, verse 18, okay, we're like animals. How does he follow that up? How are we like animals? And this is question five. Sort of here. So how are we like animals?
We die.
Die. Is he saying we don't have a soul?
That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the physical body.
Okay. Anybody want to elaborate on that? Where do our bodies go? To the dust. Where does our spirit, or, you know, some translations have breath there. And if you look that up in the Old Testament, it could refer anything from the wind to the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the waters. And so the context determines really the meaning of this here. But what's he driving at? What's his perspective? What's his overall perspective? We started in chapter 1. He keeps repeating it.
This is just everything under the sun.
Everything under the sun.
In the physical world.
Okay. When we look out and you see a man die and an animal die, what difference do you see? You can't see any difference in that. Just, we're all going to the grave. We're all headed there. But he makes this reference, you know, who knows, the spirit of man goes upward, the spirit of the animal goes down. He's saying we can't really see that. We can't really test that. But what does the Bible teach, of course, about man and his nature? Okay. Soul is eternal. Anything else?
Toward the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 7, dust will return to earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God.
Okay. Yes. The body returns to dust, spirit goes to God.
See, what I was just going to say in all of this, what he's establishing for us is there's a finite nature and there's an eternal nature.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be able to distinguish those two and then, of course, place the value on that which is eternal, not that which is limited or finite. Because all these things we're talking about, you know, there's a time, there's a season, there's a beginning, there's an end. But there, to God, there is no beginning, there is no end.
Okay. Yeah, he lives in eternity. He lives outside the bounds of time. Right? We don't. We live within the bounds of time. Anything else to elaborate on there? If we're going to the grave, what's it telling us? Okay, our soul will return to God who gave it, returns under his control, the rich man of Lazarus, you know. God took Lazarus by angels, escorted him into eternity, took the rich man and escorted him into torments, took him into torments, threw him into torments. So when we are alive, we have control. We can do things. We have decisions and free will and everything. When we die, that comes to an end. God takes over. And we'll talk more about that in Ecclesiastes 12. But verse 22, so I perceive that it is nothing better than for a man that should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. We need to do what we can while we can. Trusting in God, keeping our focus where it needs to be, Ron?
Isn't he saying that our works are going to follow us?
Our works will follow us. Exactly right. They will most definitely follow us. We're going to leave, we will leave a record. We will have a record headed into eternity to face the judgment. But, you know, we have time here on this earth, and we need to do with that time what we can in serving God and enjoy life while we have life. Again, he's not a fatalist. Any other thoughts there? Mike.
I was going to say, just as you pointed out when we first started this, there's a time to be born and there's a time to die. And everything we just talked about is in between, and now we're wrapping up. Now it's time to die.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Lord willing, we'll jump into chapter 4 next week.